minimal evidence that we have for dark matter and all that we can learn about dark matter through that evidence. But we really don't know what dark matter is made of. And there are different ways they were looking for it and trying to understand really what is its nature. So there are several models beyond the standard model of particle physics that have been proposed that actually naturally predicted the existence of a new particle or a number of new particles where one of these particles has the right properties that dark matter should have and explain the and be in agreement with all observations. So these two graphics just illustrate the variety of scenarios that exist. And if you plot those scenarios as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle and the scattering cross-section with ordinary matter, you see that these scenarios cover several decades in both parameters. And this is another way to put all of these scenarios. So basically in this plot, in this Venn diagram, you see a very large number of beyond the standard model scenarios, and the red line highlights which of those scenarios actually have a good dark matter candidate. And you see it's really a lot of them. So what I'm going to focus today is the search for WIMPs, weakly interactive massive particles. And example of such models are, for instance, supersymmetry or models of extra dimensions. So how do we search for WIMPs? And you probably know this by now, but there are three canonical ways to search for WIMPs. You can hope to produce them at colliders, specifically now at the LHC, when you have interacting standard model particles, proton-proton collisions at the LHC, and you can hope, we might hope to produce new particles there that have the right properties to be the dark matter. However, in colliders, you can't verify that the particle lives long enough to actually make the dark matter. You can also look for dark matter in direct detection experiments when a dark matter particle basically travels to your detector and interacts with the detector material. And then in that case, you'll have, by just looking at that interaction, some information on that on the dark matter particles. Another way to look for it is through indirect searches. In this case, you are looking for dark matter annihilation or decay in space. Dark matter annihilating or decaying can, or in some models, is going to produce the standard model particles, and there are several experiments that are searching for that kind of signal, and that's what I'm going to focus on. So, as I said, indirect searches. With indirect searches, you're searching for the byproducts of dark matter annihilation or decay. In this case, this diagram illustrates dark matter annihilating into W's or Z's or quark, and then you can produce a set of standard model particles, and then you're looking for the signal that is generated by the stable particles that come out of that interaction, such, for instance, as gamma rays, neutrinos, or charged particles. So you can have neutral particles like photons and neutrinos or charged particles. The more promising candidates to search for a signal of dark matter in direct detections are neutral particles, because as for issues of propagation, and as I go into more details later, neutral particles travel straight to you from the source and don't experience energy losses, at least in the case of photons at galactic scales when you are talking about gamma rays. For the charged particles, the most promising candidates are antiparticles, because antiparticles are not produced in large abundances by cosmic rays, and so they will have you will have basically just a smaller background to have to deal with. Also very important in indirect detection are multi-wavelength observation. So if you have dark matter annihilating, you can have gamma rays that come from that interaction directly, but you can also have the emission at other wavelength, say your dark matter annihilation process produce electrons, and then you can look for that electron signal directly. But also you can look for the secondary signal that you have from those electrons that produce at other, that produce radiation at wavelengths such in from all the way from radio to gamma rays as they propagate through the galaxies and interact. So as we have discussed yesterday, electrons will radiate synchrotron emission in the magnetic fields of the galaxies. They can interact through inverse Compton emission with the radiation fields in the galaxy or with through Bremsstrahlung properties with the gas. And so in addition to the direct signal that comes from the electrons, you can search also for the additional signal that you'd expect coming from these processes. So as I said, neutral particles are generally more promising targets for indirect detection. They experience no loss of energies as they travel from the source to us, and that is true for neutrino, and for gamma rays is true at least at galactic scale. Gamma rays at high energies, say above tens of GeVs, or more particularly at higher energies, as they travel from, say, a galaxy far away from us to us, at high energy they are attenuated by interacting with the extragalactic background light, and so you'll see some cutoff in the energy in the spectra for those gamma rays. They also would point back to the source and preserve the spectral information so that they had when they were produced. And so you'll get a lot of information about the processes that generate them. And that's very important in distinguing the signal, if the signal is coming from just dark matter annihilation or decay, or if it is actually just coming from cosmic rays interaction. Charged particles, on the other hand, lose directionality and lose energy on the way to us, and so important information on their origin is lost. So if you consider the average magnetic field of the galaxy, of a galaxy like the Milky Way, that is of the order of microgauss. So if you calculate the gyro radius of, say, 100 GeV electron or protons, If you put that plug in the numbers in, you'll find that the gyro radius for a proton or an electron that has this energy, it's a 10 to the minus 4 parsec. 10 to the minus 4 1 parsec is 3.26 light years. So this distance is very small for galactic scale. So that tells you, so in a typical source that is close to our sun, as a distance from us of the order of 100 parsecs. So you see that if even an electron that is produced at a source that is relatively close to us is going to change direction many times in the magnetic fields of the galaxy before it gets to us. So even for sources that are relatively nearby, we are losing already information on where they were produced. So we discussed a little bit energy losses for cosmic rays yesterday, and electrons, especially at energies above the roughly 1 GeV, they primarily lose energy through synchrotron and inverse Compton emission, while protons primarily lose energy by scattering off of the interstellar gas. And what these two plots are showing you are the energy loss timescales as a function of the kinetic energy. Here is for nucleons, and protons are up here, and here for electrons and positrons. And the scale here, this is 10 million years for the protons, and the scale here starts at 1 million years for the electrons. And the different lines basically tell you the dependence of the time scales for the different interaction processes that these cosmic rays experience. And so you can see from here that, for instance, electrons and positrons can radiate a lot of their energy in a much shorter times then a nucleon would lose energy through this inverse Compton and synchrotron processes. So they will not travel, especially at high energy, very far before they lose their energy. So what does that mean? So that means that if I want to, if I look at electrons, say at five, if I detect electrons with energies of 500 GeV, that means that those electrons have come from relatively close to the sun, because electrons farther away than that would not reach the sun because they would lose their energy. And so this, for 400 GeV electrons, that distance is of the order, it's of say 500 parsecs or so. So if you then look at 100 GeV electrons, you can look, see a little farther. Now it's about 1.5 kiloparsecs. If you look at antiprotons, then you can start seeing things at the galactic scale for protons. It's true both for protons and antiprotons. So for gamma rays, however, the distances that you can see, as I said before, are larger than galactic scale, as the gamma rays at galactic scales are not attenuated. Okay, and this obviously, these processes of energy losses and deflections in the magnetic field affect both the cosmic rays that are produced by a dark matter process, and obviously, as they affect, as well as we discussed yesterday, cosmic rays that are, say, for instance, accelerated at a supernova remnant or at a pulsar. So, and I'm going to as I go through the different signals that we are looking for dark matter, I'm going to point out the things or the aspect of propagations that are more relevant for those particular searches. So, but now let's see what the signal that we are looking for looks like. So this is the flux or the differential flux that we would expect to see when we're searching for a signal of dark matter annihilation in gamma rays. And you can factor out this quantity as the product of two terms, one that depends on the particle physics scenario that explains the dark matter, and one factor that depends on how dark matter is distributed in space. And you probably have seen some of these things already, but the particle physics factor depends on things like the annihilation cross-section, the mass of the WIMP, and the spectrum of the photon that is produced by that particular, by that interaction. The dark matter distribution, so the differential flux scales as the square of the dark matter density and depends on the integral over the line of sight of the square of the dark matter density. So basically, if I say I want to look for, I want to calculate the J factor for the, I don't think that's me. Okay. If I want to calculate the J factor that I would expect for the dark matter halo of the Milky Way by looking at the galactic center, I have to integrate the square of the dark matter density towards the direction of the galactic center over some solid angle that I am covering. So if you want to see, to have a prediction for the, again, for this flux, instead of dark matter annihilation, you want to write it down for dark matter decay, then you replace the dark matter annihilation and the mass of the WIMP here by 1/2 the lifetime of the dark matter particle and its mass. And then the flux is now going to scale as the square of the density, but just as the 1 power of the density. If then you want to write this, the differential flux for charged particles, then the expression is going to be a lot more complicated than that, because charged particles, you will have to include the propagation for the charged particles. So you'll have the injection spectrum will be the spectrum that comes out from the dark matter annihilation or decay process, but then those charged particles are going to propagate, and that's going to affect the signal that you are that you are trying to detect. Yes.
What is BF, and how do you calculate that? Whole
that's the branching spectrum ratio.
Oh, I
see. So right, it's basically the number of or the energy spectrum of the gamma rays that you expect for a given branching ratio.
And then
so
how
it can
do
be.
You calculate the N gamma?
Right, that's going to depend. Okay, so if you, it's going to depend on what the annihilation final state is. So it can be in BB bar and it can be in W's and all, then you'll have prediction of what those, you can actually calculate those things.
I see.
Right? As long as I know what final state a dark matter particle annihilate into, I can calculate this. Okay. So for the particle physics scenario, as I just said, the spectrum is going to depend on the final state if you're discussing annihilation of the annihilation process. So this, the plot down here, shows the spectrum if I assume a dark matter mass of 1 TeV, and the spectrum for this dark matter candidate, and these lines, so the steeper spectra on this plot show the spectrum that I expect, that I would expect to see if the annihilation goes primarily into light quarks and also heavy quarks. So if anything, both the light and heavier quarks are like the top and the bottom, and the heavy gauge bosons give you sort of a spectrum of this this shape, a steeper spectrum. Well, if the annihilation primarily goes into lepton in the final states, the spectrum is not as steep, and so for annihilation into tau, I would expect to see something like this, and this is the electron, and this is the muon. And maybe throughout the talk, I'm going to use terms like the spectrum is harder or the spectrum is softer. What I mean by that terminology when I say hard is that for some given spectrum, when I say the spectrum is hard, it means that it's relatively to the, it has more, gamma ray yields are higher energy relative to the lower energy than a soft spectrum such as this has. So a softer spectrum falls off more steeply compared to a hard spectrum. That's because I might be using those terms a little later on. So as you can see, the spectra, depending on the annihilation final state, can vary quite a bit. And the annihilation final state is going to depend on the particle physics scenario. So it might not be exclusively into quarks or exclusively into leptons in the final state, but it might go some fraction of the time, say 20% into taus and 80% of into bottom quarks, for instance. And so the spectrum is going to be a combination of shapes like this, and so it can look quite different. The other thing that you can that it can happen is that the annihilation will give you just a two-body final state, like two gamma rays, but those processes are and the signal in that case will be a gamma ray line, right? Because if you have dark matter particles, they annihilate. They are that annihilation. So dark matter particles are not relativistic. Their annihilation is basically at rest. So each of the gamma rays that come out of that interaction is going to carry the mass of the dark matter particle in energy. So you're going to get a mono-energetic signal coming from that kind of interaction, and that will show up as a line, a spectral line in your detector. And this kind of signal has been searched for, and however, in most models, this process is loop suppressed, so is expected to be very faint. Finally, the dark matter distribution, I've discussed that a little bit yesterday. Depending on the searches that you perform, you have to rely very heavily on the dark matter distribution that is predicted by simulation. This is in particular a plot that we saw yesterday, is the density of the dark matter halo multiplied by R, where R is the distance from the center of the dark matter, from the center of the dark matter halo. And so depending on how cusp your peak that the profile is at the center of the dark matter halo, you can get very different intensity for the signal that you would expect coming from this direction in the sky. And so that is, you have, when you're looking for this kind of signal, you have many uncertainties. You don't really know the underlying particle physics scenario, so you don't know what the spectrum looks like. And in general, you don't really know well enough how dark matter is distributed. But as I show, there are some cases when the actual dark matter distribution is really not a very important issue. This slide summarizes the experiments that I will discuss. So I will spend most of my time discussing dark matter searches with gamma rays, and I'll cover this this experiment. And we've seen some results from Fermi and some of the ground-based Cherenkov detector yesterday when I was talking about the cosmic ray propagation, and in particular when I was talking about observation of supernova remnants. And I'm going to discuss those experiments a little bit more in detail. Then I'm also going to discuss the searches for dark matter with the charged particles, and if I have time, I'll also discuss the searches with the indirect searches with neutrinos. So for now, let's focus on gamma rays. There are a number of gamma ray detectors that exist and that have been used for indirect dark matter searches. And these are the ones that have given us the best sensitivities or the best reach so far in these searches. Three of these are on the ground and one of them is in space. And so when we are looking, as I said, the signal that we are looking for can be factored out into these two terms that have uncertainties related to the underlying particle physics model and the dark matter scenarios. So what can we learn if we see an excess in indirect detection? Say I look at the galactic center, or I look at one of the satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, and I see an excess. What I can get from the information in indirect detection is information about the annihilation cross-section of that process. I can get information about the mass of the dark matter particle, because the spectrum that I get in gamma rays from dark matter annihilation cannot go past in energy. The gamma rays obviously cannot reach energies higher than the mass of the dark matter particle. So when the gamma ray spectrum that I observe for this signal is going to cut off, so the cutoff that I observe in the spectrum is going to give me some measurement of the mass of the dark matter particle. The other thing that I can learn is, based on the shape that I can measure, I can get some information of what the final state the dark matter annihilated into. So if I observe something that is steep like this, then I can infer that mainly the annihilation happened into quarks in the final state, or heavy gauge bosons. If I say see something that's harder like that, I can infer that mostly the annihilation occurred into leptons in the final state, or something in between. So I can constrain the phase space for the annihilation cross-section and WIMP mass and get some information about the annihilation final state. If I don't see any signal, I can, depending on the sensitivity that I expect from a given target, I can set constraints, again, on the annihilation cross-section as a function of the WIMP mass. So I'll have a region that is ruled out, because if the cross-sections were larger than some value, I would actually have seen a signal. If I don't see anything, I can rule out those regions. And then there are allowed regions that are still beyond my reach. So in this space of annihilation cross-section and WIMP mass, mostly we want these experiments to be sensitive to a thermal WIMP. So a thermal WIMP is a thermal WIMP that is in thermal equilibrium with the ordinary matter or baryonic matter in the early universe, and a freeze out eventually it decouples, and that establishes the Rayleigh dark matter density. And so if I'm looking at a WIMP, so I'm looking at a dark matter particle that interact with baryonic matter with an interaction cross-section that is at the level of the weak scale, and if those particles have a mass of the order of 100 GeV, of 100 GeV or so, to be able to actually derive the correct Rolle density, the dark matter annihilation cross-section has to have a value of a factor of a few times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. So this is really in a vanilla WIMP model, and this is the reach, at least, that I want this experiment, the search for dark matter to gamma rays to have. So these are the target values that I want to be able to reach. So the shape of the constraints, and you will see, are going to depend at the low energy range. They're going to depend on things like, well, the specific sensitivity of your instrument. As you go to low WIMP masses, well, then you'll have fewer and fewer gamma rays that are being produced. So your sensitivity is going to go down as your signal becomes smaller. If you go to larger WIMP masses, if the mass of the WIMPs are being large enough, you are going to have a lower number density of the dark matter particles. So again, you'll expect to have fewer annihilation, meaning a smaller annihilation cross-section. Otherwise, you'll start under-predicting the relic density. So at some point, you're just going to run out of sensitivity. This slide summarizes very briefly the differences between ground-based and space-based gamma ray experiments. When you put a detector on the ground, you're sensitive to gamma rays. So basically what happens is the gamma rays in the cosmic rays, whether they come from conventional processes of dark matter, depending on their energy, they are going to interact in the atmosphere, and only the more energetic ones are going to reach the ground. So if your detector is on the ground, your energy threshold to detect the gamma rays is very roughly at the level of several tens to 100 GeV and higher. If you are in space, on the other end, you can reach lower energies, but then you are limited by the size of your detector in how far or how high you can go in energy. Experiments in space, and Fermilab in particular, have a larger field of view. So that is the fraction of the sky that they can see at any moment. This image here, this gray cone, is showing the field of view of the LAT, which can cover 20% of the sky at any time, while the smaller, or the thinner cones shows the field of view of detectors on the ground, which is covers just a few degrees. Also, experiments in space have a greater duty cycles. They don't have limitations like a ground-based experiment due to, for instance, atmospheric conditions. And you can achieve, by moving your detector, you can achieve all sky coverage. Well, you can't do that with experiments on the ground. On the ground, however, you can afford to have a larger collecting area, and that gives you a bigger sensitivity. So what this plot is showing is the flux sensitivity as a function of the energy of the gamma ray. This is the sensitivity for experiments in space that are sensitive to the lower energy range, and experiments on the ground that have a higher sensitivities, and they can cover higher energies.
What is the use of angular resolution in terms of the image interference? Like, why is that important?
It's really actually very, very important, because it's telling you where the gamma rays are coming from. And you can think, so roughly at 100 GeV, all of this experiment on the ground and in space, I have an angular resolution of 0.1 degree. Approximately, space experiments get worse as you go to lower energy. While ground experiment more or less keep that resolution, and it's not really that good. And if you compare it to other wavelength, say if you look at an experiment like the LAT, I can detect a point source, but given the depending on issue also how bright that source is, in some case the error on the position of that source is large enough that if I want to determine what kind of source is emitting the gamma rays, and oftentimes you do that by looking at multi-wavelength. So I see some point source in gamma rays has a certain spectrum, and then I look in the same part of the sky with another instrument, say in X-ray and in radio, to actually have a full spectrum for the source to determine what it is, whether it is a pulsar, a supernova, a remnant, or something else. And sometimes it can happen that your error signal in gamma rays is large enough that there are in X-rays a whole number of other sources, and same in radio. So you're not really sure where those gamma rays are coming from. So angular resolution is very, very important. And it's something that gives you a lot of information on where these events are actually coming from.
So it helps you take out the visible matter, basically, of your measurements.
Absolutely, right.
Pinpoint the point sources that you see in the sky.
Absolutely. So what I just said applies in general to everything, and in particular for dark matter, yes. It really gives you a lot of information where it's coming from. And if you can see things more clearly, you have a much easier time in saying, oh, this is actually coming from pulsar, this is coming from gas, if you can visualize it better. Okay, this is where the gamma ray ground-based experiments are located. We have two in the northern hemisphere, Veritas and MAGIC, while HASS is in the southern hemisphere. Not going to go through all the parameters. They're roughly similar in energy range. MAGIC has a bigger detector, so it can go lower in energies. The angular resolution is about 0.1 degrees. Energy resolutions are between 10 and 15%, and the field of view are pretty small, some say compared to what Fermi has, of the order of five degrees or so. The way this detector works is, say, you have a gamma ray, it interacts in the atmosphere, and it produces an electromagnetic shower, and the particle in the shower produce a Cherenkov radiation, and that's what the detector in ground-based experiments are measuring. And so you can get information about the energy of the gamma rays that produce the shower, and information about the direction. And obviously, in addition to gamma rays, you have charged cosmic rays that produce a shower. So that is one of the things that you have to fight, is to discriminate the gamma rays for things like showers produced by electrons, and also to some degree produced by protons. This map is in celestial coordinates, and that is telling you what part of the sky, sorry, it's in galactic coordinates, and tells you what part of the sky experiment, in particular, this is Veritas, a place that are in the northern hemisphere, can see. And this is in pink, the part of the sky that has, which is in the southern hemisphere, can see. And so this is a limitation of the ground-based experiment. They, just because of their location, they can't image the entire sky. HASS can look at the galactic center, while an experiment like Veritas, unless you're looking very close to the horizon where you have some additional complication, you can't see the galactic center. So they're very complementary in their coverage. Fermi, on the other hand, can view the entire sky. As I said before, it has a field of view of about 20 degrees. This is an animation of the Fermi satellite orbiting around Earth, and the pink cone is telling you what fraction of the sky it's monitoring at any instant. The orbit of Fermi is 565 kilometers above the ground. And with this all-sky observation mode, it can view the entire sky every 3 hours, which corresponds to two orbits around the Earth. I'm not going to go into the detector details, but this is just some plots that are showing you how the performance of the detector strongly depends on energy. This plot on top shows the acceptance of the detector in the energy range that Fermi covers, and is roughly constant and pretty high in the between 1 GeV, 1 and 100 GeV. And then it falls down at lower energy, and it starts dropping off at higher energy. So there are different curves here. because you, depending on where the gamma ray interacts in the detector, you there are the experiment, the actual events have different properties. For instance, the back events, so the blue curves on these plots, are for back interacting events. That is related to the way the cracker in Fermi is made. It's made where the sensitive material is silicon, and there is passive material to increase the chance of gamma ray to interact. And the thickness of this passive material, which is tungsten, is thinner in the upper layer and thicker in the lower layers. And the events that are interacting in the upper layers, upper or thinner layers, are called the front interacting events, while the ones interacting in the thicker layers are called back interacting events. And the back interacting events, because they are interacting in these thicker tungsten layers, they have worse angular resolution. So because of the multiple scattering in the tungsten, you don't get as good information about the direction of the gamma ray that produce the shower. And this, the plot here on the left, is showing you the angular resolution for front interacting events and back interacting events. 68% containment, the solid line, and 98% containment, the dashed line. And that is just simply what we call the point spread function, and it tells you what fraction of that source is contained within some radius. The 95% containment line are quite a bit higher than the 68% containment, because the point spread function of the instrument has long tails. So to contain the entire thing, you have to go to larger angles. So if you look at 100 GeV, the resolution is at the level of 0.1 degrees, but as soon as you reach, say, 1 GeV or so, now your angular resolution is becoming quite big. It's or the 68% of containment is becoming quite big, and it's about one degree. And it gets worse as you go to lower energies. And this plot shows the energy resolution. Also, the energy resolution is energy dependent, and the best we can achieve is at about 10 to 100 GeV, and is at the level of a few, you know, slightly above 5%. This is an image of what we expect the gamma ray sky should look like in gamma rays produced by dark matter annihilation. This image is in galactic coordinates, so the very center of this image is the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and the horizontal here is the plane of the Milky Way. The inputs in making this kind of maps are the dark matter distribution, or the prediction for the dark matter distribution in the Milky Way dark matter halo that comes from cold dark matter simulation. And this is one of the things that we've seen yesterday, that cold dark matter simulation predict the dark matter halo of a galaxy like the Milky Way to be very peaked at the center. And that is where you have in gamma rays, or where you expect to see the brightest signal, plus a lot of substructures. And the substructure will show up in an experiment like Fermi as point-like sources, or depending on how close that source is to us, they might actually may also be able to resolve the extension to some degree. So these are the main targets that we are using for the indirect dark matter searches, and the ones that I will focus the most on during my talk. There are other searches that are performed, the search for spectral lines that I will cover if I have time, also extragalactic dark matter signal. That's another thing that you can search for in gamma rays. You can look also a galaxy cluster. You can also search for an isotropy, and most likely I won't have the time to cover these. This is, on the other hand, what the real data collected by Fermi looks like. So again, this image is in galactic coordinates. This is the center of the galaxy. This is the plane of the Milky Way. What Fermi sees with 4 years of data, it's more than 2,000 sources. Most of those sources are extragalactic in origin, mainly they are AGNs. There is still a significant number of sources like pulsar and a smaller number of supernova remnants that are in our galaxy, and they're mainly concentrated along the galactic plane. But the brightest feature that you see in this image is this band that crosses this, this bright horizontal band. That is the emission that is generated in our galaxy by galactic cosmic rays that are accelerated, say, a supernova remnants or some fraction of them at pulsars, and produce gamma rays as they travel through the interstellar medium and the interstellar radiation fields. And this emission, in particular, if you want to look at a signal, if you're searching for a signal of dark matter towards the direction of the galactic center, is one of the biggest complications that you have to deal with, because there are still a lot of uncertainties in how to model it. And that is going what I'm going to discuss in the next few slides. So this diffuse gamma ray emission, I might call it, I might alternate between calling it diffuse gamma ray emission or interstellar emission. But what I mean by using either of those terms, as I said before, is the emission that is produced by cosmic rays interacting with the interstellar gas and radiation fields. So this is what that, if you break, you can break down that emission into the three main physical processes that produce it. Cosmic ray electrons interacting with the radiation fields, and I've mentioned that before, can upscatter these low energy photons in the radiation fields up to gamma ray up to gamma ray energies, and the inverse quantum emission will have a morphology that looks something like this, that traces the interstellar radiation fields of the galaxy. So these interstellar radiation fields are made out mainly by starlight, or starlight that has been reprocessed in the galactic dusk, dust, and they, so they'll have, you expect to see something brighter toward the center of the galaxy, in the direction of the center of the galaxy, when you have the larger concentration of stars. And also there is some contribution to the radiation fields coming from CMB, but obviously that emission will be isotropic. Then for Bremsstrahlung processing and pi zero decay processes, again, Bremsstrahlung is generated by the electrons interacting with the interstellar gas, and pi zero emission is generated by the protons interacting with the interstellar gas. These two processes are going to trace the gas in the galaxy. And that is the morphology that you see in these images. Obviously, what you expect to see, what you expect the gamma ray diffuse emission to look like, is going to depend on the properties of cosmic rays, on how they are generated, where they are generated, and how they propagate. So if I want to make a model of the diffuse emission to use as a background to Fermi, I need to have all these informations. And a lot of these things are not known. We discussed yesterday supernova remnants as the sources of the acceleration of cosmic rays. So if I want to predict what the emission in gamma rays that I should get coming from cosmic rays, I need to know how these sources, or the supernova remnants in particular, are distributed in the galaxies. I can detect some supernova remnants, but we haven't detected enough to have a good, and we don't really have a good sample over the entire galaxies to have a good determination of what that distribution is. So this is one of the big uncertainties that we have when modeling the gamma ray diffuse emission. I don't really know with good precision where these cosmic ray sources are. And one of the things that we do, instead of using supernova remnants themselves, is to use proxies for the distribution of supernova remnants. So meaning up, looking at other sources whose distribution I can determine with more accuracy, and that I believe are actually tracing also the distribution of supernova remnants. Another thing that we don't really have good knowledge of is the cosmic ray halo size. And I touched on that a little bit yesterday when I was talking about propagation, and I discussed diffusion in a box. And so you need to know the confinement volume of the cosmic rays in the galaxy. And we don't really know very well how large that volume is. So this is another thing that I don't know very much about, and other things like the distribution of gas in the galaxy. So I can look at wavelength like radio, and I can trace the distribution of things like, say, the atomic gas in the galaxy, but not well enough to make a good prediction for what I expect to see in gamma rays. Since these things are unknown, and as well as other things, like, for instance, what exactly is the injection spectrum of the cosmic rays as they leave the source, I can have some educated guess of what range of parameter would this all these variables span, and build a grid of model that, based on that range of assumptions, and determine, based on those assumptions, what the gamma ray sky would look like, and then take all those predictions that come from that grid of models and compare it to the data and determine which of those models predict the data best in gamma rays. So this kind of exercise has been performed. And so what you see is that after you do that, that there isn't one single model that gives you the best answer, but there is a set of models based on different combination for the values of these parameters that actually gives you overall a pretty good description of the sky. And this map here illustrates how well one of the models that performs best looks like. What is shown here is always in galactic coordinates. So again, galactic center here, and this is the plane of the galaxy, is showing the fractional residual between the data and the model. So data minus model divided by model. Good agreements is shown in green. And you can see that over the entire sky, you have an agreement at the level of 10 to 15%. So in average, that model of cosmic rays give you generally good description at large scales. But if you look at some specific direction of the sky, you see that there are excesses and deficits that stand out. I'm not going to go through all of those, but one thing that you notice is, for instance, there are these blobs below, above and below the galactic centers. And those are actually, and this is this image up here is only with data, without any background subtraction, but with a higher energy cut. And you can actually, just by looking at the data without even subtracting your gamma ray background model, you can already see these structures. And these are again shown here with some background model subtraction. And this was actually, it comes from the paper that they discovered these structures. And these structures are very extended. They extend up and down between plus or minus 50 degrees in latitude. And they're believed to generate from an outflow from the center of the Milky Way, maybe jets coming from the black hole at the center of the galaxy, or maybe they've been originated by a starburst event, so a time where a relatively short amount of time where there was a lot of star formation activity. So even though we don't understand these things exactly, and we don't know the exact interpretation, if you are looking for a signal of dark matter coming from the dark matter from the galactic center, you, in addition to the background that you expect to be there, you also have to worry about these additional or new gamma ray emission sources that we have found in the Fermi data, which are particularly difficult to model as you get closer to the galactic center, where the background it's harder to model. Now, in this slide, I'm focusing on a slice on the galactic plane, which is quite narrow in galactic latitude. It covers a range between minus 8 and plus 8 degrees, and it extends in longitude between minus 80 degrees and 80 degrees. And what this plot is showing here is the energy spectrum. This is it's multiplied by E squared. The dots here show the data, and the magenta line shows the prediction that I get for one of the diffuse models. It overall gives me a good agreement over the entire sky. Up to 1 GeV or so, there is roughly the model and the data. So this lower panel is showing the fractional residuals between model and data as a function of the energy. This is telling me that up to 1 GeV or so, roughly model and data are at the same level, but above 1 GeV, there is an excess in the data. And here the gray band is the instrumental uncertainty. So this is uncertainty on the effective area. So this excess is statistically significant, and it is larger than the systematic uncertainty of the instrument. So what I'm trying to show you here is that what I'm getting to is the search for dark matter coming from the galactic center. And so these are the issues that we have to worry about when we are doing that kind of search. What this is telling you is that the models that we have we are not, at least at this scale, not predicting the emission that we observe from this specific part of the sky very well. So there are a number, well, you can say, well, there is a dark matter signal there, and that's what you're seeing. But there are plausible explanation for the excess, the one that you see at the QGV energy range, and also for the one that you see at higher energies. What you might be seeing in this energy is a contribution from unresolved point sources. And when I say unresolved point sources, I mean point sources that are not bright enough, each of them individually, to be resolved by the detector. But if I have a large enough number of point sources, each one of them emitting gamma rays, that is going to give a significant signal in my detector, and I would observe that as an extended emission. And so if the unresolved point sources is made out of pulsars, pulsars have spectra that peak in the few GeV energy range. And since I don't have that contribution in my model, they might be contributing in this range. For the higher energies, these energies are too high, above 10 GeV, to have a significant contribution from pulsars. But what might be happening there is that the model assumption, or the assumption that I have in my model, break down at some point. So in the model that I have described before, in general, when you talk about cosmic rays origin and you propagate through the galaxy, propagate them through the galaxy, you make the assumption that the spectrum of the cosmic rays that we measure locally with cosmic ray experiments is representative of the entire galaxy. And that possibility may or may not be true. So what this might be indicating that if you look a region of the galaxy towards its center, then the spectrum of the cosmic rays in those regions is a little bit harder than what we measure locally, and that translates into them producing a spectrum in gamma rays that it is a little bit harder and is going to look in your experiment as an excess of those energies. Yes?
Is there any reason to expect a correlation between this excess and the Planck measurement that there's way more dust polarization than predicted?
No, because I don't believe that in that case, right, that this is going to give you information about that, right? And because also this extends to, I think it's also a different region of the sky. I think that polarization measurement, I can't remember exactly where it was. Okay. So one of the big assumptions that we make when we model the cosmic rays is to, as I said before, to assume that the locally measured cosmic ray spectra are representative of the entire galaxy. How well do we know that? What evidence do we have that is actually true? And can we actually check this hypothesis? One thing that we can do with gamma rays is to look at the emission coming from gas. And in particular, this analysis has been done by looking at the gas emissions of proton-proton interactions in hydrogen gas and looking at some specific parts of the sky where most of the gas in those regions come from atomic gas, and you don't have the same complication in determining a contribution in the emission in gamma rays that you'd have if you use molecular gas that I might discuss later. And also the gas in these regions or at this latitude is local, meaning that is located up to about 1 kiloparsec from us. So you're not probing a very long line of sight through the galaxy where you might be looking at very different or very far away, where the emission is coming from far away parts of the galaxy. Here, if you're looking in this direction, you're constraining yourself to the emission within 1 kiloparsec from the sun and that region only. Yes.
So if I understand correctly, the idea here is that we're using the cosmic rays that we see from Earth, and we're extrapolating that it'll be the same cosmic rays also in the center of the galaxy?
Yes.
Is there a possibility that the cosmic rays that we're seeing right now are already affected by dark matter or something? Like,
yes.
Contaminating our background, I guess?
Right. Yes. There is. And I'm going to discuss that probably this afternoon. So when you look at these parts of the galaxy, these are the data that you observed, and the black line that goes through it is actually the prediction of what that spectrum would look like if you assume that the spectrum of the cosmic rays within 1 kiloparsec is the same as we measure at Earth. You get good agreement, and so you can convince yourself that within these distances, at least your hypothesis is true. But then if you go to larger, farther away distances, so now this is the spectrum of the gamma rays shown by the blue dots that is measured by Hess looking towards the center of the galaxy. This is a two by two region around the galactic center. And you know that that emission is originating in the neighborhood of the galactic center, so over 8 kiloparsecs away from us. So this is the spectrum that Hess measures, and the gray band is the spectrum that you'd expect to observe if the spectrum of the cosmic rays at the galactic center were the same that we measure locally. And you see that the measured spectrum and the predicted one have different slopes, and the one that is measured by Hess is harder. So what you expect to measure locally has an index of about 2.7, right? It's going to trace the spectrum of the cosmic rays. What you observe at the galactic center it's a harder index, 2.3. And so that might mean that the spectrum of the cosmic rays at the galactic center, it's harder. And this is a good reason to believe that that's actually happening, because here you're probing the spectrum of cosmic rays that really have been freshly accelerated instead of having traveled for a very long time throughout the galaxy. So you're really grabbing the protons being accelerated at higher energies, again, because they are freshly accelerated. So this is some evidence that your assumption on the locally measured spectrum of cosmic rays may not be true, at least at the center of the galaxy. So now let's move a little bit closer towards the galactic center. So when you look at the signal of gamma rays coming from the galactic center, you're not only detecting gamma rays that are coming from the neighborhood of the galactic center, but you're detecting gamma rays that are coming from the entire line of sight. So you are probing very different environment in the galaxy, which makes building a model for the background emission very complicated in this direction. And this is also the part of the sky where you expect the intensity of cosmic rays, the density of the radiation fields and the gas to be the highest. Also, you have a large density of point sources, and depending on how you model your background, the point sources that you detect may vary in spectrum and in number, and they may overlap in the line of sight. And this is also the part of the sky where you expect a signal coming from new physics to be the strongest. And I'm going to skip this since I don't really have much time, but just one thing I wanted to point out, I'm not going to go through the plot, is when we model the cosmic ray emission in gamma rays, what we do is we make an assumption for the distribution of cosmic ray sources, then you have to make those cosmic ray interact in the galaxy. And say you want to model the gamma rays that are coming from protons interacting with the gas, and so you need to know where the gas is placed with respect to the sources of cosmic rays. So what we do is that we take the galaxy, we divide it in a galactocentric annuli. So from these two-dimensional images that I get in radio, from the position of the gas, I need to decide where to place the gas radially with respect to the center of the galaxy. I need to spread it out. And that is something that you can't do very well or well at all if you're looking towards the center of the galaxy. And the reason for that is that if I detect a gas emission in radio, I get the distance information if I take the velocity that I measure in radio based on the Doppler shift of that of those emission line or absorption lines. And then I use the rotation curves of the galaxy. So based on the velocity of the gas and the rotation curves of the galaxy, I can determine how far the gas is from the center of the galaxy. But if I'm looking straight towards the center of the galaxy, the gas is either moving, say, this direction or that direction, but it doesn't have a component of the velocity in the direction of the line of sight. So I really don't have velocity, a reliable velocity information to know where to place it in the radial direction. So you see, these are the distribution of molecular gas in different rings from closer to the galactic center to the farthest one. And then you see that in the innermost part of the galaxy, the gas emission has been smoothed out, and you can see it in some of these maps, just because I don't know where to place the gas, so I just interpolate the gas that I have outside of this region inside a plus or minus 10 degree region in longitude. So this is just to give you an idea of the complication of modeling the diffuse emission towards the galactic center. And I think I'm going to have 5 more minutes. This I have discussed already. Another possible contribution is the one that is coming from unresolved point sources. And you can model an unresolved population of pulsars. And there are predictions that would tell you that if you look at the towards the center of the galaxy, there might be thousands of these unresolved point sources that are contributing. And I've said also this already, another complication is that if you're looking at the center of the galaxy, you don't really know how what that distribution, what the profile of the dark matter distribution looks like exactly. And this is, again, the plot I showed before of the density of dark matter as a function of galactocentric distance. And this is just to give you in the different prediction for the dark matter profiles. And this is the Fermi single photon angular resolution. So if Fermi actually does see a signal in gamma rays, you can actually, depending on how big that signal is, you can actually get some information on how big the profile is. So I'm going to quickly, I don't see Itai. Oh, you're there. So I can conclude now or? Okay, all right. So now I'm going to discuss some of the searches that have been performed in the last 5 years looking for a signal of dark matter coming from the galactic center. A first claim of an excess coming from the galactic center direction was made in 2009, and it was found to be consistent with dark matter annihilation primarily into bottom quarks. And for a dark matter particle that has had a mass between 25 and 30 GeV. Fast forward to 5 years later, more detailed analyses of the Fermi data have been performed in this time. And again, What this analysis conclude is that, again, there is an excess, and now the specifics of the dark matter signal have slightly changed, but again, the signal is found consistent to a dark matter particle, again, primarily annihilating into bottom quark, with a mass in the range between 30 and 40 GeV, and with an annihilation cross-section that is very close to what you expect for a thermal relic. And this, if you look at these plots here to the left, that is the emission in a 40 by 40 degree region around the galactic center. In this analysis, the galactic, a couple of degrees around the galactic plane that have been masked. But this is the residual emission data minus model. It shows that there is this excess concentrated toward the center of the galaxy. The morphology of the excess has been found consistent with an NFW profile, which is very closely centered at the position of Sagittarius A star, that is the dynamical center of the galaxy. And it has a profile that is very close to an NFW profile, but it has a slightly larger slope. So for an NFW profile, the slope of the profile in the innermost part gamma is equals to 1, and this what this analysis finds that is the signal is more consistent to something a little bit steeper than that. That, as we discussed yesterday, might be coming, say, from the effect of baryonic feedback. This signal has also been interpreted just mainly based on spectral, on consideration on the spectrum, on the shape of the spectrum, picking at a few GeV and cutting off, as an unresolved population of pulsars, because pulsars have very similar spectra. The issue of the morphology, you might ask, why would pulsar have the same spatial distribution as dark matter? There is some evidence by looking at tracers of pulsars, in particular tracers of millisecond pulsars, that the distribution of these objects might be very peaked at the center of galaxies, and you get that kind of information by, say, looking at the distribution of X-ray binaries in the Andromeda galaxy. But it is hard to believe that if you can really convince yourself that this excess is spherically symmetrical out around the galactic center, it's not really something that you would expect from millisecond pulsars. And also that they would extend high in galactic latitude as high as this excess seems to be. Recently, and I thought that maybe Mariangela discussed this a little bit last week, but I'm not sure into how much detail she went into, is to use to test this hypothesis that actually the excess comes from an unresolved population of pulsars. Again, these are sources that are too dim for the detector to resolve them. But what you can try to look for is to look for some non-Poissonian photon statistics, and which may be something that you would get if you had some distribution of unresolved sources right below your detection threshold. So meaning that the excess is not coming from some smooth distribution, but from a distribution that it's peakier than that because of the fluctuation that are coming from these unresolved sources. And what this analysis found is that the excess appears to actually be consistent with an NFW distribution. So, a distribution from unresolved point sources that has an overall morphology of an NFW profile for dark matter annihilation. I think this is a very good idea, but I think it is still too soon to draw any firm conclusion. So I think I can stop here and pick up this afternoon on the analysis that we're doing within the Fermi collaboration, again, on the Galactic Center. Okay. That's all, thanks. Yes.
Is there It's probably looking for lines coming out of the black center also.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have a few. Well, there were some claims a couple of years ago that there was a line. And even though people say a line would be a smoking gun signal of dark matter, most people didn't believe it, and then it just went away. And I can explain that this afternoon. But so no, as of today, there isn't a line signal. Oh, sorry.
You mentioned the Fermi bubbles. Is there any way that that could be related to dark matter source?
So no. And the main reason is really the morphology that they have. You don't really expect them. So for one thing, that's, the Fermi bubble have very sharp edges. And so that points to some event that happened in some limited amount of time and not the kind of morphology that you would expect from dark matter annihilation that would have a steady emission. And also the bubble shape is not what you expect them to have. So that's really not pointing in the direction of dark matter. Yes.